So do join me if you can. Same time, 9 o'clock here on BBC Radio 3. Sunday Morning is a unique production for BBC Radio 3 with studio production today by Neil Miners.
When daffodils begin to peer. For many cultures across the world, the four seasons define life through a constant cycle of rebirth and renewal. For the Radio 3 lunchtime concert, pianist Joseph Middleton and four of the UK's finest young singers present a wide range of songs inspired by spring, summer, autumn and winter, and explore the wide gamut of emotions that juxtapose and intertwine human feelings with events reflected in nature. Tenor Andrew Kennedy, soprano Sophie Bevan, mezzo-soprano Jennifer Johnson and baritone Marcus Farnsworth perform songs inspired by the seasons from the Lammermuir Festival in Haddington. The Radio 3 lunchtime concert this week from Tuesday to Friday at 1 o'clock on BBC Radio 3.
And you're listening to BBC Radio 3. It's midday and time for Private Passions with Michael Barclay.
Welcome to the House of Commons, where we're in the office of the Chief Whip, because my guest today is Sir George Young. He's the son of a diplomat. Following the general election in May of 2010, he was appointed Leader of the House of Commons and Lord Privy Seal. In the September reshuffle, he returned to the back benches, albeit with a companion of honour to his name, which must have been quite a pleasant thing to achieve.
Yes, it certainly cushioned the blow of leaving the government, I think, for the third time. And I was delighted to have been given this honour, which has been given to relatively few people.
But the blow was re-cushioned still further when, almost in the blink of an eye, you returned as Chief Whip.
I was looking forward to a slightly quieter life on the back benches when I was summoned back to the colours. If you're in public life and the Prime Minister asks you to do something, of course your instincts are to respond positively. So much sooner than I had ever envisaged, I was back in the front line.
It was a very appropriate appointment in a way, because you're a bicycling Chief Whip.
I am indeed. I've bicycled ever since I came to the House of Commons. I used to be able to bicycle from Acton to the House of Commons, which is 7 miles, in less than 30 minutes. I have to say I couldn't do that today.
In your time as Leader of the House, I think you achieved several things of which you're very proud.
When we came in 2010, the background was that over a number of parliaments, power had been taken away from the House of Commons and taken up by the executive. And what we wanted to do, both sides of the coalition, was to return to the House of Commons some of the power that it had lost. And we wanted the House of Commons to be more bulldog and less poodle. And so we set up the Backbench Business Committee, and the agenda of the House is no longer the monopoly of the Leader of the House. And actually, some of the best debates we've had in this Parliament have been on subjects chosen by the Backbench Business Committee. They feel an ownership of the subject, which I don't think they did when the Leader chose the material. And we now elect the chairs of the select committees instead of the whips, and we've got the e-petition system. So we have slightly rebalanced it. And I think Parliament is a stronger, more effective place, and if Parliament raises its game, then the government has to raise its game as well, and everyone benefits.
I imagine that, given, as I said at the beginning, your father was a diplomat, that you did quite a bit of travelling as a family when you were young.
My father was a diplomat, and actually both my grandfathers were also diplomats. And I was brought up in a range of capitals all over the world, Rio, Rome, Paris, Beirut, and Brussels. And went to schools in many of those locations, and at the time spoke foreign languages like Portuguese and French. But I'm afraid, over time, those skills have left me, and I'm now a monoglot.
Music has been very important to you too.
Yes, more as a consumer than a producer. But I've always been keen to support amateur music societies in my constituencies. We had the Ealing Choral Society, which was very strong. When I was in West London, we got the Andover Choral Society in Northwest Hampshire. So I'm very keen to support live music. And, of course, there's the Parliament Choir, which is really excellent. I'm happy to say I don't join in because that would lower its quality, but I support it whenever I can. I suppose I'm a consumer rather than producer of music.
I think the first music that we're going to hear was also the first music that you remember hearing.
Well, I thought about including The Laughing Policeman, Michael, but I thought that would be an insult to the listeners of Radio 3. And instead I've chosen Gilbert and Sullivan. The first operetta my father took me to was The Pirates of Penzance, gradually weaning me away from pop music towards something slightly more serious. The Pirates is my favourite. And in this piece, the policemen are being urged by Major General Stanley to slay the pirates when the foeman bears his steel. And the Major General's daughters are joining in the exhortation, singing Go to Glory. And to begin with, they sing separately, and then they come together. And it's a glorious piece of music by Sir Arthur Sullivan.
When the foeman bears his steel,
the Lancelot, the Lancelot,
we uncomfortable feel,
the Lancelot,
and we find the wisest thing,
the Lancelot, the Lancelot,
is to slap our chest and sing,
the Lancelot.
For when threatened with the mute,
surrender up, surrender up,
and your heart is in your boots,
surrender up.
There is nothing brings it round like the trumpet's martial sound, like the trumpet's martial sound.
Surrender up, 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 surrender up.
Attentions of our men, such expressions don't appear, calculated men to cheer, who are going to meet their fate in a highly nervous state. Still to us it's evident, these attentions of our men.
Go and do your best endeavor, and before links will sever, we will say farewell forever. Go to glory and the grave.
Observed a great distress on the wrists and on his press, and a reference alack to our chance of coming back. Still, perhaps it would be wise not to carp or criticize, for it's very evident these attentions are were meant.
Yes, it's very evident these attentions are were meant. Evident, yes, were meant. Evident, ah, yes, well meant.
Go.
Of course, it turns out that the pirates are all members of the House of Lords. They're all noblemen who have gone wrong. So hence the parliamentary connection with that piece.
When the Foeman Bears His Steel from Pirates of Penzance, Act 2, by Gilbert and Sullivan, we heard Muriel Harding singing Mabel, Joan Gillingham, Edith, Richard Watson, not the laughing policeman, but the sergeant of police, Martin Green, Major General Stanley, and the Doyley Cart Opera Company, the new Promenade Orchestra, all conducted by Isidore Godfrey. Do you think that when you have something like a choir in Parliament, or indeed anywhere, that it's not just the appreciation of music, but the appreciation of doing something as a team that one gains sustenance from?
I'm sure there's a lot in that. And if you look at the choral societies that I've come across, quite often attached to the choral society is quite an active social programme. And for many people, the rehearsals are one of the high points of the week. And it also gives them, I think, a sense of pride when they can fill a church, as they do in Andover, and give a first-class performance. So I'm very keen on promoting where I can and supporting amateur operatics, music societies, choral societies, and also keeping Gilbert and Sullivan alive. I think there's a risk that if we don't keep those societies going, Gilbert and Sullivan will gradually fade away, and I think that'd be rather sad.
It's another opera, but opera rather than operetta, George Young next. And I think it has a rather important place in your heart for other reasons than merely the music.
Don Carlos is, I think, my favourite opera. Verdi's a fantastic sort of dramatist. And I proposed in the second interval of Don Carlos back in the 1960s, probably meant to do it in the first interval, but a glass of sherry at the Crush Bar was required. The question was put in the second, and I think it's a fantastic work, and I've seen it many times since. And there's a song right at the beginning, the sort of the friendship song with Don Carlos and Rodrigo, where they swear eternal friendship and go to do battle on behalf of the Flems in another part of Europe. And it just reminds me of that occasion in Covent Garden many years ago when I embarked on marriage.
Pace.
Music from Act Two, Scene Two of Verdi's Don Carlos. We heard Placido Domingo as Carlo, Cheryl Milne's Rodrigo, with the Ambrosian Opera Chorus and the Orchestra of the Royal Opera House, Covent Garden, conducted by Carlo Maria Giulini. You mentioned earlier, George Young, the things that you felt you achieved as leader of the House and which you're proud of. And one of those was e-petitions, where ordinary members of the public, if they could get enough support through signatures, could get Parliament to debate something that they wanted. I think you needed something like 100,000 signatures.
Yes, what we wanted to do was build a bridge between citizen and Parliament and make sure that the issues that we were discussing in the House of Commons were the issues that people were concerned about, and that's why we introduced the e-petition system. Speaking from memory, about 12 have gone through the threshold of 100,000. It was a somewhat arbitrary figure, and we can adjust it if we need to. And once it's gone through the threshold, an MP has to adopt it. And then there's a debate, and I think all the ones that have got popular support have been debated. A lot of subjects have been debated that no leader of the House would ever have chosen, because actually they are quite difficult and awkward ones, EU referendum, prisoners' votes. But I think that's good for the House of Commons.
Let's talk a little bit about now your job as Chief Whip, which I imagine, just from what one sort of reads and what one's seen on television, that it's an even more pressurised job.
It's a certainly very different job, and the Leader of the House spends his life talking in the House of Commons, and the Chief Whip never speaks at all. So there is a certain amount of role reversal. But paradoxically, some of the things which I did when I was Leader of the House makes the life of a Chief Whip slightly more difficult, in that we've given away, for example, patronage. In previous parliaments, the Whip's office have had enormous influence on who becomes chairman of select committees. That patronage has now gone entirely, and those chairs are now selected by secret ballot of the House of Commons.
Do you still think that's a good thing from your new position?
Yes, I do. And actually, one of the things that's happened in this parliament is the select committees have become more effective, and the centre of gravity is beginning to shift from the chamber to the select committees. And I'm in favour of the House of Commons doing its job effectively, and empowering the select committees, giving them a mandate they didn't have before, has made the House of Commons a more effective place, and so the government has had to respond by raising its game as well.
Do you feel a little bit sometimes like a headmaster sitting in here? I mean, I looked for a cane underneath the desk, couldn't see one, but I could see on the wall a list of famous excuses that have been given to chief whips in the past for failure to vote.
I think partly because of what we've just been talking about. in that some of the levers are no longer in the hands of the chief whip. The job has changed, and we're much more into persuasion and reasoning than some of the tactics which you may have read about in some of the more dramatic pieces of literature, or indeed some of the things that have appeared on television when previous incumbents of my job have appeared in a rather unsympathetic light.
Now, one of the pieces that the Parliament Choir, which you mentioned just now, has performed is the Haydn-Nelson Mass.
The Parliament Choir started about 15 years ago, and they perform twice a year, now in the Cadogan Hall, but they have performed in Westminster Cathedral. And they recruit from members of both houses, officers of the house, people who work here, and they've now got a slightly broader embrace of friends and families. I try to go, and they did the Nelson Mass quite recently. It's a very, very cheerful piece of work by somebody who clearly believed in the afterlife. And although it's a work written in D minor, it moves to the major key as we come to this piece, which I think is marvellously uplifting. great stuff. One of my ancestors was an admiral alongside Nelson, so that particular piece of music has additional resonance for the young family.
Et Resurrexit from Haydn's Nelson Mass with Luba Organosova and the Arnold Schoenberg Choir, Concentus Musicus, Wien, directed by Nikolaus Ononkor. Of course, if Mozart hadn't been alive at the same time, Haydn's star would have risen even further, I think.
Yes, and one of the things that I'm interested in is looking at some of the contemporaries of Mozart, Haydn, Schubert, who were almost totally eclipsed by the great men of their time. And I think some of their music is very good, and we may come on to that later. And I think that, in a sense, we owe a lot to Bach, because it was Bach and then the Bach sons that led to the Mozarts and the Haydns and laying the foundation.
But even Bach went out of fashion for a while, and it was Mendelssohn that rekindled an interest. So it can happen to anyone.
Absolutely. Some of the Bellinis and Donizettis that are so popular today, one of them, I think, wasn't performed for something like 150 years in this country. And so these things come and go.
It is Mozart next, a wonderful aria from Don Giovanni.
The two reasons why I've chosen this. For 23 years, I was a Member of Parliament in Ealing, Ealing Acton, home of the Ealing Film Studios. And the best film that was ever made is Kind Hearts and Coronets, starring Dennis Price and Alec Guinness, who plays eight members of the Gascoigne family. And at the nub, what Dennis Price, as Mr. Mazzini, is trying to do is to avenge the injustice done to his mother, who, when she died, was not allowed to be buried in the family vaults because she had married an opera singer. And right at the beginning of the film, she falls in love with Mazzini Sr., and he sings this song from Don Giovanni, Il mio tesoro intanto, which I think is one of the best songs ever written, given to Don Ottavio in the opera, who's something of a wimp. But nonetheless, it's a fantastic song. So it's Mozart, but also it's Kind Hearts and Coronets.
Oh!
You can see why Mrs. Mazzini fell for him.
Il mio tesoro from Don Giovanni, Act 2, Scene 2 by Mozart. Luigi Alva sang Don Ottavio with the Filarmonia Orchestra conducted by Carlo Maria Giulini. We stay in Ealing, actually, for the next piece too, don't we, Giorgio?
We do. The Ealing Choral Society was a fantastic, and still is, musical achievement, and it had a very good conductor, James Gaddarn. And I went along one evening, and they played something which I'd never heard performed live before, and actually I've never heard performed live since, which was Donizetti's Messa di Gloria. And I went away straight away and bought the record. I just can't understand why it isn't performed more often, because not only the piece that I've chosen, the Cum Sanctu Spiritu, is a great piece of music, but actually it all is. And if there's any organiser of any choral society listening to the programme, wondering what they might do, they could do worse than get the score for this piece of music and have a go. Great stuff, and there's pots more of it in the same piece.
Cum Sancto Spiritu, from the Messa di Gloria by Donizetti. Daniel Borst, Hélène Josseau, Jean-Luc Viala and Vincent Letexier with the regional choir of Provence, the Alps and the Côte d'Azur. We also heard the orchestra of the region Avignon-Provence, conducted by Michel Piquemal. George Young, we were talking about how you've helped to improve one element, at least, of democracy in the Commons. And you're in a rather good position, I should have thought, to have thought out for yourself what might be the best way forward for the Lords. I mean, we all know nothing's much going to happen now, but whether, in fact, democracy would be best served by an elected house or whether appointed experts are still the best way forward?
I've always believed we should move towards a predominantly elected second chamber. And long before we had the recent debates in the Commons, I was an advocate back in the 1990s for a predominantly elected second chamber. I think having a system whereby roughly three quarters of the present membership of the House of Lords have been appointed by four or five people is quite difficult to defend. And also it's far too big. And so I was disappointed when we couldn't get the programme motion. I think it's not going to go away. Some government at some point in the future will have to address it.
What about the argument that if the Lords had a mandate that would bring them into a greater conflict with the Commons?
Yes, I don't buy that argument. The way we proposed it was that 80% of the upper house would be elected, but they'd be elected in tranches, a third at a time. And so at no point would the House of Lords have a more recent mandate than the House of Commons, because two-thirds of the elected ones would have been elected before the last election for the House of Commons. So I don't buy that argument. I think that if you're going to have people passing laws that other people have to obey, there ought to be some gentle brush with democracy to give them legitimacy. And I think it's the lack of legitimacy that I find worrying at the moment.
Might it mean that you wouldn't get people like, for example, Robert Winston? I can't imagine people like that standing for...
Well, 20% would be appointed. And I think it is important you get the distinguished scientists, doctors, civil servants, people from the armed forces. But the political appointments at the moment go in by the nomination of the Prime Minister or leader of the opposition. I think those ought to have some mandate. But you're quite right. We should continue to have great and good people who don't belong to political parties. And the 20% would allow that to happen.
I'm really thrilled that you've chosen the next piece by Schubert, since it's one of my favourite. And, you know, I think there's something marvellous about shorter pieces by composers. I'm thinking of the Adagio and Fugue by Mozart, for example, which we don't hear that often. And then this little Kurtzsatz by Schubert is perfect in its way.
Well, like you, I'm very, very fond of this. It's one of Schubert's unfinished pieces, of course, the Unfinished Symphony being another one. And rather like the Unfinished, it begins with a sort of shimmering of the violins. I like it because it represents to me, to the extent that any piece of music can, life, in the sense that it has turmoil and tension interposed with calm. And it seems to me that is what life's about. You have a sort of a busy week, and then you go home and have a bit of peace and quiet. And this piece, the way it moves from the turmoil to the calmness to the turmoil back again, just seems to me to be a statement that this is sort of what life is all about.
Thank you.
Music from Schubert's Quartettsatz, Deutsch 703, played by the Belcher Quartet. George Young, I wonder a little bit about some of your other possible passions apart from music. I mean, certainly when you were younger, you were no slouch on the squash court. I wonder whether you kept that up.
Well, I kept on playing squash until I was about 50. But unless you're very fit, you die on the squash court because the mind makes appointments the body can't keep.
I moved to tennis for that reason.
Well, indeed. I also moved to tennis, more doubles now than singles.
But the trouble is that with squash, it's a different technique. And in fact, in tennis, you have to keep your arm much straighter, whereas squash is all wrist, of course.
Indeed, squash is very much wrist. And I suppose I had a slightly unfair advantage on the squash court in that I am quite tall. And it is very difficult to lob me on the squash court. On the other hand, if you have a high centre of gravity, it's slightly more difficult to change direction. So the advantage of height...
And that's
slightly,
not a political comment.
No, indeed. So I still play a bit of tennis, and of course I bicycle to work whenever I can, and hopefully that keeps the waistline down.
Scott Joplin next. This is, I imagine, partially because it's just such a wonderful tune. But...
Yes, I regard Scott Joplin rather like a sort of black Schubert, in that a tremendous gift for melody and an ability to write good piano music. He came from a very unpromising background. He would have qualified for a pupil premium, a poor Afro-American who worked on the railways, but then had this gift for music. And I remember when his music was revived in the 70s by Joshua Rifkind, I bought a cassette, shows how long ago it was, and driving home from Parliament to my home in Berkshire, I would listen to these Scott Joplin melodies, and they're fantastic. What I like about music is basically melody and something that appeals to you straight away, rather than something that's like a sort of crossword puzzle. You have to try and work out what on earth the composer was meaning when he wrote it all down.
Scott Joplin's Maple Leaf Rag, played by Joshua Rifkin. We were talking earlier, George Young, about Haydn and Mozart, and I expect it was Hummel that you were referring to when you said we might elaborate on the way some composers, and indeed artists in every genre, get rather overshadowed because they fall just under the lee of someone incredibly well known.
Well, you mentioned, Michael, that Haydn might have achieved greater prominence if he hadn't been overshadowed by Mozart. And there are a lot of people working away in the early 19th century. There was Krommer, Dittersdorf, Salieri, Spohr, and Hummel. And I want to do something for the also-rans. I've done something which probably hasn't been done before on your programme. I've chosen a piece that I've only heard twice. Most of the pieces people choose they've heard and got to know. And that's because there's a lot of good music out there. And I'm all in favour of giving it a go and giving greater sort of coverage to some of these people. I suppose there's an analogy with the Olympics. People win a gold medal, but they are a fraction of a second or a fraction of an inch ahead of the second, and in turn they're only just ahead of the rest of the field. And I just wonder whether the same isn't true of music. There's some great people, Mozart, Beethoven and Schubert, but are they really so far ahead of the rest of the field? And isn't there a lot of good music out there which is really worth discovering? And is it not possible that the best work of some of these people might be better than some of the less notable compositions of the great three? And that's why this piece by Hummel is something I'd like to end with.
Great sense of humour as well, false endings and sudden pauses.
It's a marvellous piece of music, and there's so much else that he wrote. I suppose he's best known for his trumpet concerto, which does get a lot of coverage, but there's a lot of stuff which he and all the others wrote, and I hope that more people will go out and listen to it, and perhaps some of the amateur groups can give it a whirl next time they're putting together a programme.
The Vivace Assai, the finale of Hummel's Octet Partita in E-flat, played by the Albion Ensemble. Well, thank you very much, George Young, for doing for Hummel and Andy Murray and allowing him to break through centre stage.
Michael, it's been marvellous to not be grilled about the performance of the coalition government, but to talk about something that's really important, namely music.
Thank you.
Sir George Young was talking to Michael Barclay. Next week on Private Passions, there's another chance to hear the actress Celia Imrie talking to Michael Barclay about her favourite music. That's at the same time next Sunday at midday. Private Passions is a Classic Arts production for BBC Radio 3. The producer of today's programme was Chris Marshall.
Every Sunday on BBC Radio 3, the choir celebrates the very best of choral singing. And this weekend, we'll be bringing you the first of six special editions of the programme, brought to you by leading experts from right across the choral world. Over the next few weeks, Paul Miller talks about composing for state occasions, Ken Burton and Harry Christophers explore gospel and sacred choral music, Mary King celebrates works inspired by traditional folk music, and Eric Whittaker talks about what inspires him as a choral composer and performer. I'm Susie Digby, and I'll be starting this sequence of programmes by showcasing the dazzling talents of some of the world's best youth choirs. Join me for The Choir this afternoon at 5 o'clock.
And that's here on BBC Radio 3. If you've recently tuned in, a very warm welcome to you from me, Jonathan Swain. In a couple of minutes, the early music show, Lucy Skeeping, exploring the life and music of Henry Purcell's composer Cousin Daniel. Then at 2 o'clock, the Sunday concert, a colourful one this afternoon, with Juanjo Mena conducting the BBC Philharmonic, setting off with Oliver Nussen's Flourish with Fireworks. Violinist Renaud Capuçon then takes us to Hollywood with Korngold's Violin Concerto. And we return to Juanjo Mena's native Spain for the rest of the programme. Clara Muriz joins the orchestra for an evocative Turina song cycle. And the concert closes with Manuel de Falla's ballet score for his tale of a Spanish magistrate behaving badly, The Three-Cornered Hat. The Sunday concert is at 2 o'clock this afternoon. 1 o'clock now, and a summary of the news. 25 senior local Conservatives have written to David Cameron, urging him to shelve plans to legalise gay marriage until after the next election. A delegation is delivering a protest letter to Downing Street, warning that there's growing discord within the party about the issue, which could cause significant damage at the ballot box. MPs are due to vote on same-sex marriage on Tuesday. David Cameron will begin 2 days of talks with the leaders of Afghanistan and Pakistan this evening, aimed at overcoming mistrust between the two countries and supporting the Afghan peace process. The Prime Minister will host a dinner with Hamid Karzai and Asif Ali Zardari at Chequers tonight, ahead of formal discussions tomorrow. In Iraq, at least 16 people are reported to have been killed in a suicide car bomb attack on police headquarters in the northern city of Kirkuk. Medical officials say 70 others were wounded. France says its warplanes have bombarded Islamist bases in Mali near the northern town of Kidal. French and Malian forces are trying to secure the area, which is the last Islamist stronghold following the fall of Timbuktu and Gao. The bombardment follows the French President François Hollande's visit to Mali yesterday. Trained negotiators are trying to free a 5-year-old boy taken hostage 5 days ago in the American state of Alabama. The gunman is holding the boy in an underground bunker at his home in Midland City. He'd earlier shot dead a school bus driver. The kidnapper has been named as Jimmy Lee Dykes, a Vietnam veteran. Environmental officials in Western Australia say they've used the distress call of a young dolphin to lure a large pod of the animals to safety after it appeared they would strand themselves in shallow water. Officials caught the juvenile dolphin and took it out to deeper water, where its distress calls enticed the rest of the pod to follow. And the weather: sunny spells will develop in central and northern England and eastern Scotland, but it'll stay cloudy and damp elsewhere. Winds will strengthen across the UK overnight, with gales and increasingly wintry showers in Scotland. Other areas will become largely dry. And that's the Radio 3 news and weather, with the time at a little after 2 minutes past one. Well, now for the early music show, and today Lucy Skeeping's looking at the life and music of a much-neglected 17th-century composer. ¶¶
harpsichordist David Pollock with a short toccata by Purcell. Not Henry, though. That was actually by Daniel Purcell, a composer who for generations we all thought was Henry's brother, but now turns out to be his cousin. 11 years younger than his famous relative, poor old Daniel has lived in Henry's shadow for more than three centuries. But thanks to a new disc, which includes some of his chamber music never recorded before, well, it seems that he's at last getting the chance to emerge as a serious composer in his own right. We're looking at some of his life and career in today's programme. But first, let's hear another of his pieces from that same new disc. It's David Pollock on the harpsichord again, this time joined by the violinist Hazel Brooks in a sonata in A major.
Thank you.